It is the ultimate saturated fat, and for generations, we have been told by noted and respected authorities to avoid eating saturated fats. But some of us simply could not help ourselves, and so we ask, butter or margarine?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1084th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in San Blas who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, wherever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I'm Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Strube. Hello, Jason.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Jason.
Yes.
Butter or margarine?
Butter. All
butter.
The way.
Butter. Yes. I thought you were a vegan.
Well, you know.
Okay. You can only be so vegan, right?
Yeah.
Okay, folks, throughout history, we the people enjoyed a profound culinary and spiritual relationship with the saturated fat butter. Then nutritional powers that be decided saturated fats are harmful to human health and that butter, the ultimate saturated fat, should be avoided in favor of the saturated fat margarine. Now, in rebellion against those powers that be, many are renewing that ages-old relationship we had with butter. Those in rebellion include many in the scientific community who are reexamining many of the studies used to convince us to eat margarine and finding that, holy smokes, maybe we have been fooled into eating the wrong fats. And so we ask, butter or margarine? And who better to ask, and probably who better has a more pointed thought about it, than Elaine Kosova, who is the author of Butter, A Rich History. Elaine, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael.
So good to have you aboard. Which came first, the foodie, the pastry chef, or the author?
The nutritionist. I have a degree in food and nutrition.
Ah.
And then I became a pastry chef.
Okay, but let me ask you this then. Did you get a degree in nutrition because you were a foodie?
No, actually, I got a degree in food and nutrition because I fell in love with the science of, at that time in the early 80s, nutrition was just starting to become its own really dedicated science, and there was a need for nutritionists and better dietitians, and so I really kind of fell in love with the science, the physiology of the body.
Mm-hmm.
But then I realized at a certain point there wasn't much creativity in that work, and I'd always loved cooking and baking, so then I went to pastry school and was a pastry chef for a while until I found my way into a test kitchen at a magazine, Country Living Magazine. And so through that, I stayed at Country Living for 9 years and worked as a test kitchen editor and then associate editor, worked my way up to writing. And then my book, this is my first book, Butter, Rich History.
Well, congratulations on your first book.
Thank you.
That's a pretty big deal to get the first book out because they're always the most difficult. And what was that epiphany moment when you were in the test kitchen and serving as an editor and whatnot that you thought, why not write a book about butter?
Actually, it was fairly recently. My work as a test kitchen editor was in the 90s, but it was the idea for this book really came about when I became editor of a magazine called Culture, which is a cheese magazine, and that was in 2008. So this magazine was all about cheese, and I spent almost 5 years in the dairy world kind of behind the scenes, of course, becoming an expert on cheese.
Mm-hmm.
It was like doing your master's in cheese. But through that experience, I began to try a lot more butters and see the nuances in the butter market that didn't exist. Certainly when I was growing up, there was like one or two brands of butter. And now we have imported butters and cultured butters and whey butter and high-fat butters, not to mention goat butter, sheep butter. And even within each of these categories, there are nuances. And so, again, I came back to the science. It was so intriguing, like, how is this possible when butter is essentially one ingredient, you know, milk, fat, cream. Mm-hmm. And how do you get all these nuances? So that's really, that was the trigger for what I thought would just be a really good article. And then the more research I did, I was like, wow, and look at the history of butter. So, you know, my book has quite a bit of dairy science, but it really is mostly about the history of, you know, people with butter, people and butter.
Which is always the fun thing to me, to pick up almost any piece of food and trace it back into history, because it's a wonderful way of looking at us.
Yes,
as people.
Exactly.
And you know, when I got your book, Butter, A Rich History, I do what I always do with a book. I just open it up to wherever. This is what I found when I opened Butter up to wherever. One of the vivid memories of my Alsatian childhood was going with my grandmother to her butterman in the Highland, tasting his butter, listening to the conversation about the minutiae of weather that went into this particular summer's butter. Just as down on the other side of the mountain, my vintner cousins were talking about how the weather affected this year's wine. Mm. Now, you know, people generally don't think of butter in those terms, do they? I mean,
no, because we've had so much industrial butter, and in the States we've had mostly our own industrial butter. There just hasn't been a lot of variety in the market until now. But if you take five or six butters, you know, some from different countries and different regions, you know, that have gone through, like I said, either culturing or, you know, more high fat, if you put them side by side, you will really see, you know, that you can make an argument for butter's terroir in the same way you would with wine. Absolutely. And it's really fascinating.
And thus, away we go. Now, have you ever made butter?
Oh, yeah. Plenty of times.
Plenty of times.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this. Have you ever milked the cow?
Actually, no.
Then you're missing out on the complete experience, right?
You know, with all my dairy experience, no, I've always stood there with a pen and paper in my hand, usually taking notes.
Well, I've been through the whole process. I think, you know, I was raised on a farm in Montana that was very traditional in that it had animals and crops mm-hmm. growing in the field. And the animals, of course, provided much of the food that we ate. And dairy was a huge part of that. You milk the cows in the barn. You hauled the buckets of milk into the shed, and you poured it into the separator, and away you go in. You had milk, and you had cream.
Good for you. Yeah.
And so tell us a little bit about, before we go to our first break in a few minutes, what exactly is butter?
Well, it's technically a fat in water emulsion. I mean, cream is a fat in liquid emulsion. And when you make butter, you basically turn it inside out so that you have liquid in fat emulsion. So that's the technical answer. It really is just concentrated milk fat, and it's churned through the, you know, cream is about 40% milk fat. So you churn cream. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, you're agitating all these, you know, zillions of little fat molecules. And each of those molecules has a tiny membrane sort of cloaking it. And with the agitation, you break that cloak on the membranes of each fat molecule, and that causes all the fat pieces, little guys, to all rush together into pieces of butter. So you have to drain the liquid that's left over, because you'll always have liquid in buttermilk. But the fats that coalesce, that's essentially butter, and it's really, you know, it's quite a simple process.
It sounds similar to making ice cream.
Well, you know, ice cream involves
you're churning.
Yeah, but it has, you know, ice cream has so much to do with temperature, doesn't it?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to use ice, right?
And there's no liquid that, you know, you drain off when you do ice cream. So it's definitely similar in that you're shifting the molecular structure to make ice cream. But, you know, I find butter making is even easier. I mean, you basically just need good fresh cream. You can put it in a jar, a food processor, a stand mixer, anything to agitate it.
Well, good. And in that regard, I'd like you to take us back to the beginnings of butter and people, and people and butter, and the relationship we developed long time ago, and where that relationship has developed over the years. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today we're talking butter. What about you? Butter or margarine? Which one are you? You're one or the other. And you know, for decades, the powers that be in nutrition tried to convince us that butter was bad and we should eat margarine. And now, you know, there seems to be a rebellion going on, led by people like Elaine Kostrova, who seems to be saying that maybe we were fooled into eating the wrong butter. What do you think? 831-479-1080 is the phone number today. Pick it up. Join us. We are at 831-479-1080, and we will be right back.
Wow, MetroFarm.com says we can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
And we don't even have to own the land. We can lease it year to year.
MetroFarm.com says we can grow fruit on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, vegetables in city greenbelts, and ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
We can even grow flowers on our wooded hillside.
Get all the information you need to grow for profit at MetroFarm.com, including the complete guide to earning 5-, 6-, and 7-figure incomes by farming small parcels of land. Meet the farmers who earn the money. Find experts at MetroFarm.com who will examine your property and assess which crops to grow. Meet consultants who will help steer your project to profitability. And get the latest news about the business of growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
We've always dreamed about farming a small parcel of land. At MetroFarm.com, we can get all the help we need to stop dreaming and start growing.
Well, what about it out there? Butter or margarine? That's the question we have on the table today, and we have to find a good answer to that. We have Elaine Kostrova, who is the author of A Butter, A Rich History. And before we delve into the history of butter, which sounds like a lot of fun to me, we're going to pick up a call from Jewel, who is 80 years old, and she has a question. Go ahead, Jewel.
I am looking for butter that used to taste the same as it did 20 or 30 years ago. In agriculture, we used to feed the cows that were the milk cows with lots of grain, lots of corn, etc. Now they must be giving them hay, and I spent 30 minutes again at the grocery store trying to see if I could find something that had some of the fat that we used to love to have.
That's a great question, Jewel, and we'll ask Elaine. But you know what, Jewel? I think that's a question you could ask about rutabagas, too.
Well,
we get right down to it. Where can we find food that tastes like food used to taste?
Yes.
Okay, let's ask Elaine. Thank you for the call. Elaine, what do you think?
Yeah, good question. Well, the good news is that, you know, there are other places to find good butter besides the supermarket. You know, depending on what supermarket is near you, you might, you know, have a little selection of butters or quite a few. But I think really what you want to try to find, Jewel, is a local butter that's made, you know, on a farmstead operation. So it's, you know, it's more seasonal. It's probably a more, I would think, particularly in California, a more grass-fed diet. Because for many, many, you know, for most of human history, cows and other ruminants were eating grass.
What a perfect segue to the history of butter. And I reckon it all started with grass, right?
It started by accident, actually, butter.
Ah.
Yeah, we're pretty certain that the first butters were made at least 9,000 years ago when men started to domesticate animals, and particularly goat and sheep. So the first butters were not cow butters. They would have been, as I said, goat and sheep and possibly even yak butters because in the Tibetan plateau they were domesticating yaks way back when. But we're pretty certain that, you know, nobody realized that the milk had this kind of invisible richness in it that would suddenly, become butter. So most likely what happened, the milk was put into an animal pouch, which was generally how they took an animal skin and made a big pouch out of it. And it was, if it was kept in there for any length of time, it was sort of naturally cultured a little bit, and that helps with churning. Mm-hmm. And so at some point, that milk was, say, went on a little journey with the shepherd, you know, over the hill. So it got rocked back and forth. And
horseback,
you know, back,
a horseback ride over the mountains, yeah. Right?
Yeah, horseback churning by horseback, or, you know, or sheepback, you know. I mean, I don't think they even had horses then. So it was a very, very, very long time ago. But in any case, we're pretty certain that, you know, they opened up the pouch, and lo and behold, there was this kind of magical substance there. It was delicious and rich, and, you know, they could use it not just for cooking and for eating, but it also, butter was used for waterproofing. It was used as a medicine. So it had a lot of uses in the early world. But the first recorded history we have of butter making is the ancient Sumerians in 2500 BC. They actually had temple carvings that showed they were making butter.
And they're pretty much responsible for a lot of early history for just about everything, those ancient Sumerians.
They
must
are.
Have been a wild bunch when it gets right down to it.
Yeah, they did a lot. Well, they recorded things, you know, thank goodness. They
That's
had
right.
tablets, everything. Yeah.
So you in your book, you talk a little bit about, you open up your section of history about talking about seeing petrified butter that came from an Irish bog of some kind.
Yes, it's called bog butter, and there are actually over 400 samples of bog butter that have been retrieved from the peat bogs in Ireland, and also a little bit in Norway, too. So what we know is that the ancient peoples of Ireland made butter, and they would put it in the bog. They would put it either in some grasses, wrap it in grasses, or sometimes a wooden firkin, which was like a wooden pail. And they would bury it in the bog, presumably because it kept very well. It, you know, the bog is very acidic and it's anaerobic. You can, I mean, they pull bodies out of the bogs that are well preserved. So it's amazing for preservation. But what's really interesting now that they've found so many samples is, you know, people have been asked the question, well, why weren't they retrieved again? You know, it's one thing to preserve your butter. Why was it left there? And the answer that seems to be emerging, because of where the bog butters are found, they're actually found on the boundaries of sacred sites that existed way back when. So we're pretty certain that many of the bog butters we're finding were offerings to the, you know, a pagan offering to the fairies, to the elementals, you know, to the forces out there.
And maybe to hide some from the Vikings.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was definitely a good way to hide your butter because it was valuable. But the question is, you know, were they all left there because there was some, you know, some massacre? Probably not. So, you know, there's definitely were certain different reasons for leaving it there. But, you know, I like the pagan theory as
you know, to understand why butter had such a significant role in our history, I guess you have to think about how essential and how valuable those fats were to human survival and the nutrition they were able to deliver.
Yeah, particularly in the northern European regions, you know, when you think they have a shorter growing season than, you know, sort of the Mediterranean area, animal products were so essential for the survival of those people. They really needed butter, and they needed cheese, they needed milk, they needed all those animal products because they...
To stay warm.
You know, yeah, to stay warm, and because, again, you know, they didn't have a long growing season.
Mm-hmm. I think in the discussion between the Mediterranean diet and animal diets, and I think of the Eskimos who live on blubber.
I know.
And you think, yuck, but boy, if you lived up there, blubber would probably be a nice delicacy because it would be something that would keep you warm, whereas a bowl of spinach probably wouldn't.
Right. Exactly. Yes, metabolically, you definitely need that blubber. Yes, indeed.
So help us take us through a quick history then of our relationship with butter. Let me ask you this. Where did you attack the subject of our history of butter? I mean, if you're a writer and you're looking at, we have an interesting history, but where on earth does it start and how do I get there?
Yeah, I think essentially I ended up working my way backwards because, as I mentioned earlier, I started with the science and the craft. And the craft led me to, you know, more ancient crafts, methods of butter making. And, you know, so for instance, water buffalo butter making in India, which is very an ancient practice, and yak butter making in Bhutan. So looking at the way they actually process the milk to make the butter, you know, that sort of took me into their cultures. And by way of that, you know, I kept just stepping further and further back into history because once you connect with certain methods, you connect with the culture so much more. In particular, I was amazed to discover how many ancient cultures used butter as a sacred tool in their spiritual practices. You know, the butter was used for butter carvings. It was used to create these giant fires and flames to...
Kind of like gold, you know, kind of like gold because it was something really precious.
Indeed, yeah, it still is in Bhutan. I traveled to Bhutan, India, France, England, Canada.
Now, Elaine, that sounds like having too much fun chasing butter around the world for me.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with Elaine Kosrova, who is the author of Butter, A Rich History. Butter or margarine? What about that margarine stuff? We'll go there right back. Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. We're talking with Elaine Kosrova, author of Butter, A Rich History. Her first book, way to go. What fun. What a fun thing to even think about, butter. And, you know, you traveled around the world chasing the story of butter. As part of your career. And I was wondering, when you got to, like, India... Do they make butter out of cow's milk?
Oh, they do now in great quantity, but I didn't go there to cover that story, really. I went there because I wanted to document the really traditional butter making in India, which was with water buffalo milk.
Uh-huh.
And it's done in a process where the cream is not separated. They don't put it through a separator. They ferment the whole milk overnight as if they were making yogurt. And, by the way, this yogurt they make, water buffalo milk has about twice as much fat as cow's milk.
Wow.
And when you make this yogurt, it's absolutely the most delicious thing. so that was the first, first part.
Okay, now that you brought it up, where do we find buffalo butter?
Buffalo
yogurt.
So far, you really can't.
Okay.
There is one... brand from Italy, but it doesn't taste anything like the water buffalo butter that I had in India because, again, I think they're not putting it through this yogurt process. But essentially, they would churn this yogurt into butter in India. That was always how it was done. And then the leftover buttermilk was, of course, really tangy and delicious, and they could make drinks out of it.
Mm-hmm. And, I guess there are some... butters that would really be hard to industrialize. What are there any mammals that have not made that we have not used to make butter with, like lions or something?
Oh, it really, butter making really falls in the ruminant category of mammals. It's
so
not
grass.
Mammals. Yeah, it's those who are chewing their cud. Essentially, those are the ones that make milk that's rich in the fat that we can turn into. To butter.
Okay.
So that includes quite a lot of animals. I mean, even reindeer. People are surprised that in the Lapland region they often made butter from reindeer milk. Not a huge quantity. They didn't give a lot of milk, but apparently it was a very rich milk, and they make butter with it.
Now, one thing I understand is that Genghis Khan really relied on his horses to make milk, and that was one of the foods that fed his army. Is that true?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear it. Well, I know milk was a huge product for the, you know, mare's milk was a big product for the Scythians, you know, in that region of near Mongolia. So, you know, that was a very much a product that sustained them. It's a question about whether or not they made butter from it. It does appear that there was some cream-related product that they made from mare's milk.
Mm-hmm. I think it was yogurt.
Yeah, right. I think there was a lot of, you know, think about it. This was raw milk and warm temperatures. There was a lot of fermented milk product back in the day. You know, that was much more typical than having anything fresh, unless you got it, you know, like straight from the udder and enjoyed it fresh. But typically, even butter, there was no such thing as fresh, sweet butter until the invention of the cream separator, because all the milks had to sit out, you know, so the cream could rise. And during that process, which would be overnight, you know, it's quite a long time for the cream to fully rise, the milk naturally cultured, and so you had a lot of fermentation going on.
I remember the cream separator from my grandparents' farm. Pour the whole milk in, and you get cream, and you get milk.
Yeah, well, that was invented in 1878 by a Swedish guy, and it really revolutionized the entire, not just the industry, but dairy people's lives. You know, that was, I say, when butter essentially left home, butter making left home, it left the farm and it moved into creameries, because now then suddenly it made more sense for farmers to bring their milk to a central location. They had a big separator. They separated the milk and the cream part, and they made the butter again, you know, in factories. That's where that all started.
And then once we industrialize, once we bring all of the milks together, excuse me, we lose the flavors, right?
Well, not necessarily. No, I mean, I have to say that, you know, having visited industrial plants, their process, there's nothing inherently wrong at all with their process. It's a very pure system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of good sanitation, which we should be happy for. We also can be grateful that there's uniformity in those butters.
Right, right.
You know, your cookies always come out the same, you know. That didn't used to exist. So the problem I have is, you know, with industrial dairying, you know, the treatment of the cows. You know, in other countries, they don't put their cows on feedlot. You know, they more or less let them graze for as long as the weather allows. And, you know, it's a much more natural system.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's a separate issue. The process at the creamer, at the industrial plant, is a very good, healthy process. They don't add things to butter. They're basically, all they do is essentially temper the cream so that we get a really nice, smooth, cohesive butter.
But then we do lose that uniqueness.
Yeah, we do, definitely. They standardize the animal diet. You know, if they didn't standardize the animal diet and kind of vacuum off some of the what's called the pastoral notes in cream, they sometimes do that, we would get variations. But, you know, the whole idea of industrial food is to have the same exact product.
Right.
But that's why it's so interesting now to look for these local butters. You know, you can have your cake and eat it too, quite literally. You know, the industrial butters are great for baking, and they, you know, they're predictable. But if you want to have some interesting butters at the table to taste and you know, really detect nuances and things like that.
Which is what Jewel was looking for, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, she'd probably do well to look in some smaller specialty food markets. I have to say, like, there's a great, you know, great butter from New Zealand. There's, you know, there's a couple from California that I love. French butters.
Where do you find them?
I have to drive about an hour. I don't know about where you guys are, but I live in the Hudson Valley, and I do have a couple of...
You have to drive into the city, right?
No, not really, no.
Not quite.
No, I can go.
Well, you know, the big question to me is, why did they try to talk us out of eating butter? So that's what I'd like to pick up when we come back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, fighting the voice today, but I'll get it. The phone number is today, 831-47-1980. And the question of the day is food or butter or margarine. Why did they try it so hard to talk us out of eating butter and into eating margarine? We'll ask the question to Elaine Kosarova, who is the author of Butter, A Very Rich History. And you're invited to participate. Pick up your phone and join us. 831-47-1980. 831-47-1980. Right back. Welcome back out there. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. On the Food Chain with Elaine Kosarova, who is the author of Butter, A Rich History. Elaine, you were talking about becoming a nutritionist in the 1980s at the beginning, I think you said it, kind of at the beginning of the nutrition research industry. But yet, the nutrition industry or the food industry has been using nutrition science for decades to talk us out of eating butter. Why was that?
Well, to really understand, and not just against butter, but the whole anti-fat campaign, you know,
right.
We still are surrounded by with labels that say no fat, low fat. So, you know, that has its roots in the situation, you know, that was happening in the States around the 1960s, late 50s, 1960s. Because at that time, there was an almost epidemic incidence of heart disease. And what really kind of made the headlines was that President Eisenhower had several heart attacks in office. And so there was a kind of a hysteria developing around, you know, what are we going to do? What can we tell people to do to prevent heart attacks? And, you know, there were several theories at the time, but the one that gained all the traction, partly because the man, the scientist, you know, who was its proponent, was, you know, very, very ambitious. Some would say even a bit ruthless. But his theory, which essentially said, you know, if you eat fat, you put fat, in your arteries.
Mm-hmm.
It intuitively felt right to a lot of people, particularly politicians who were looking to make diet and nutrition policy in the States. It seemed like logical, of course. If there's fat in our arteries, it must be because of the fat we're eating in our diet. And so his, you know, Ansel Keys was the scientist who proposed this. And as I said, you know, he convinced a lot of important people of his theory, and again, it was a theory. It wasn't founded in very.
Well, he had data, right?
He
was using data. I mean, think of the seven state studies.
Yeah, but it was very cherry-picked data. For instance,
that's the best kind of statistics, don't you think? The ones that you like.
Exactly, choosing the ones that support your. He did it. He pulled statistics from seven countries that showed, you know, if you eat these countries that eat more fat, they get more heart disease. The ones that have less fat or have less heart disease. But what he did was, you know, there was a sample of 22 countries that he could have chosen, and if he had included all of them, there was no direct correlation between eating fat and having heart disease. But he chose to just show the seven countries that did show this correlation. So, you know, we started from that premise, and, you know, Senator McGovern at the time, this is 1977, he had a special Senate committee to deal with this issue of heart disease and nutrition, and they basically went with Ansel Keys' theory, and it became, you know, pretty much gospel at that point. You know, the medical community supported it, the nutrition community supported it, the food companies got around it. Mm-hmm. And said, okay, you know, we're going to get rid of fat in the diet. We're going to get rid of fat in the diet. You know, with the exception of condoning olive oil, because there was, you know, some evidence from the Mediterranean countries that olive oil,
right,
you know, less incidence of heart disease, so it must be that they're eating olive oil.
And besides, the olive oil had a very close connection with the Senate Appropriations Committee or something like that, maybe.
Well, and the vegetable oil industry.
And so then that's what it became a war between those who grow crops and those who grew animals, right?
Yes, exactly. Between the dairy lobbies and the vegetable oil industry. So the vegetable oil industry was funding a lot of the research, it helped to demonize saturated fats. And again, we look at these studies now, we've had meta studies going back, looking at all the evidence that was available in the late 70s, early 80s. And most of it has been, completely discredited, I guess.
That would be
the word, because it just doesn't hold up. They weren't clinical trials, and we didn't have the science that we have now. I mean, for instance, now we understand that some of the saturated fats in our bodies, that can lodge in our arteries, can be caused by the sugars that we eat, because our liver can turn excess sugars into saturated fats. We didn't know that back in the day. So now we're discovering that, the whole category of saturated fats is actually quite complex. There are ones that have no effect on a blood cholesterol. We look at coconut oil, right?
Right.
And it's super popular right now. It's considered practically a health food. That's a saturated fat. And yet we know that, those saturated fats it contains are actually quite good for you. And butter has a whole variety of saturated fats, including, ones that aren't saturated, like oleic acid. That's the main fat that's in olive oil. And butter is one-third oleic acid. And then it has a high proportion of stearic acid, which has been shown to have no effect on cholesterol levels. So it's fascinating now that we're kind of teasing apart the saturated fat theory as we did the cholesterol theory. Do you remember, I don't know if you're aware, in 2015, the FDA basically rescinded its policy that said people should not eat foods high in cholesterol because it makes
right.
the cholesterol level go up. So that we know that that's actually not true.
And so we're saying, oh, to heck with you guys. We're going to eat butter anyway, and there's nothing you can do to stop us, right? This is the Food Chain. We're going to pick up our last segment when we come back, and I'm going to ask Elaine if she's ever tried to cook pastry with margarine. Well, the rains fall, and the grass grows, and the ungulates eat the grass, and their bodies turn that grass into milk, rich in fats. We people, we capture those animals, and we take their milk and turn it into something to drink, something to eat. We make butter out of it. We make cheese out of it. We make ice cream out of it. We make it into so many things. But having that ability to take the milk of animals and turn it into various things we need has given us the ability to get by in the world for as long as we've been here on Earth, almost as long as we've figured out how to contain the animals long enough to get their milk, at least 9,000 years. And so it's been a huge part of our history and a magnificent way of looking at our history. And that's, I guess, is Elaine Kosova's butter, a rich history. So they tried to talk us out of eating butter, and we pretty much took their advice for a long time, and finally we just got so fed up with margarine and whatnot that we said, no, we're going back to butter. And
well, I think what happened, if I could just clarify that, I think what happened is we discovered that margarine is actually bad for us, the trans fats in margarine. So that was a big moment for a lot of people, like, oh my gosh, I've been eating this for 40 years thinking that I'm doing the right thing, and I was actually hurting my body more than if I'd had butter.
Yep, they snookered us into eating the wrong kinds of fats. So we're going back. Let me ask you, Elaine, have you ever made pastry with margarine?
I have not ever, but I will tell you that growing up, my mother used to make her pie with Crisco. It was always a Crisco. So that's a dirty little secret in my past. But no, I just love the flavor of butter and the mouthfeel. I've never been tempted to use margarine. I actually never, I said earlier I was in college studying food and nutrition, and I remember, and this is the early 80s, I remember a professor saying to me, stay away from margarine. It has trans fats, and your body doesn't know what to do with those. And that was in the early 80s. It took 40 years for that to become public knowledge.
Did you ever have that conversation with your mother?
The butter
margarine conversation?
No, she didn't buy margarine. You know, we always had butter in the house. It was just her pies. She only mm-hmm. did that.
Just that Crisco then.
Yeah. Now, my mother's from Scotland, and it was all about real butter.
Well, that takes us back to the rain.
Mm-hmm.
And where the rain falls, the grasses grow. And where the grasses grow, mm-hmm. that's where we make the good milk. You know, New Zealand, Scotland. Yeah. You know, mm-hmm. those places.
Ireland,
France. Yeah.
Yeah, many, many wonderful places.
And, so what is your advice about butter?
Well, it's a rich food. So, you know, I certainly am a proponent of butter that's from grass-fed milk. And I buy that myself, particularly for my everyday, you know, my toast, my mashed potatoes, the way I use butter in the kitchen. If I'm baking a batch of, you know, holiday cookies, then I don't necessarily buy the expensive grass-fed butter.
Because you don't need it. We're out of time, Elaine, but
yeah.
If you folks out there are not out of time to read Elaine Kosrova's Butter, A Rich History, A Great Holiday Treat. Thank you so much, Elaine, for joining us. And remember, folks, the farther you go from the source of your food, the less control you have over what's in that food.
Indeed.
Yeah. You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.